The Bishop family moved into a home in a quiet and affluent Washington, D.C. suburb. William Bradford Bishop worked as a diplomat for the State Department, and the bishops had previously lived in several countries, from Africa to Europe. Bradford, his wife Annette, and their three sons moved into a beautiful home and were soon joined by Bradford's widowed mother, Lobelia. On March 10, 1976, a concerned neighbor contacted police. She hadn't seen anyone at the Bishop home for more than a week. When authorities arrived for a wellness check, they found a bloodbath in the home, but no bodies. Later, they would learn that a week earlier, police in North Carolina had come upon a gruesome scene. 5 battered bodies piled in a ditch and set on fire. The victims would later be identified as Annette Bishop, her 3 sons, and her mother-in-law. Bradford, however, was missing. Initially, investigators suspected that Bradford may have been murdered along with his family, but when evidence began telling a different story and sightings of Bradford came in, warrants were issued for his arrest on 5 counts of homicide. It wouldn't be easy to track Bradford down. He had been in the U.S. Army, where he'd trained in counterintelligence, spoke multiple languages, and was incredibly smart and well-traveled, while also possessing a diplomatic passport. It would become a race against time, with Bradford having more than a week's head start. Recorded live alongside Nina from Already Gone at the True Crime Podcast Festival in Chicago, this is Trace Evidence, Episode 86, The Bishop Family Murders. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today's episode will be a little different, as it includes audio recorded live at the True Crime Podcast Festival last month in Chicago. Alongside Nina, the amazing host of Already Gone, we delve into the haunting murders of the Bishop family. Afterwards, you'll hear my solo analysis of the theories. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focusing on a different unsolved case each week. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at TraceEvPod, on Instagram at TraceEvidencePodcast, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. As a final note, Trace Evidence is a complete one-man operation, so if you'd like to help support the podcast, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can gain rewards such as stickers, pins, and other surprises. If Patreon isn't your thing, but you still want to pitch in, there is a PayPal donation button on the website. Today, I invite you to join Nina and I as we look at this horrifying and brutal case. This is Episode 86, The Bishop Family Murders. Bethesda, Maryland is a quiet suburb of Washington, D.C., sitting in Montgomery County. Its proximity to the nation's capital typically results in drawing in the families of those who work in D.C., who make the 7 to 10 mile commute each day. Bethesda is home to the main campus of the National Institute of Health, as well as Walter Reed Medical Center, with many involved in the medical profession living nearby. Bethesda has, multiple times, received the title of Best Educated City in America due to the large percentage of its population boasting graduate and professional degrees. Bethesda is also known as a wealthy area that, over the years, has been granted titles such as America's Most Livable City and has been listed on Time Magazine's list of top-earning towns. Over the years, Bethesda has continued to grow and expand, with the peak of its population striking in 1970, clocking in at just over 71,000 residents. Believed to be safe and attractive area, one which drew in many young families with its good schools and beautiful homes, everything would change in March of 1976, when a horrifying and hideous crime rocked the citizens of Bethesda and catapulted the area into national headlines. On March 8, 1976, at approximately 12 noon, a female caller contacted the Montgomery County Police Department.
According to the woman, she was concerned about the well-being of her neighbors, the Bishops. The Bishop home, located at 8103 Lilystone Drive in the Carterock Springs Historic District, had been exceptionally quiet for days. And as the neighbors explained, she hadn't seen any members of the family for approximately 1 week. For Montgomery police, it wasn't exactly an urgent call, and the immediate assumption was that the family had gone out of town without telling their neighbor. But the caller argued that the family, the Bishops, always told her when they were going out of town. She had keys to the home and would take in their mail and water their plants for them. The Montgomery Police Department decided to dispatch a detective to the location for a welfare check, a fairly routine act, but on this day, it would be anything but routine. Just days earlier, on March 2nd, Wilma Swain was working her post at a watchtower 5 miles south of Columbia, North Carolina. The tower granted Swain a view of more than 40 miles in all directions, and she quickly noted smoke emanating from a wooded area along the side of North Carolina Highway 94, approximately a mile from the tower. Swain quickly radioed Ronald Brickhouse, a North Carolina Forestry Service Ranger. Brickhouse arrived at the fire, just off Burton Shell Road, at approximately 1 p.m. The fire was burning along nearly 3 acres of brush, and after 10 minutes of trying to get it under control, Brickhouse returned to his vehicle to radio for backup. While making his way back through the area towards his truck, Brickhouse made a grisly discovery. In an interview with the Washington Times, Brickhouse explained, quote, "I saw a pile of dirt and walked over, and there were 2 bodies lying in the hole. It's the first time I ever saw anything like that. My belly turned, and I hustled out of there and called for the sheriff." Brickhouse radioed back to Swain, asking her to send the sheriff, though he did not specify why. For the moment, she thought he'd found an illegal growth of marijuana, or possibly a still being run by moonshiners. It would be hours before she would learn the true horror of what was unfolding. While Brickhouse waited, he found himself going back towards the scorched earth, at which time he found a gas can nearby, still burning. Beyond the gas can, he noted also a shovel and a pitchfork. It had recently rained in the area, and so the earth was muddy, and Brickhouse saw fresh tire marks. He determined that the fire could only have been burning for an hour or so before he'd arrived on the scene, and just as he was trying to figure out who could do something like this, he was joined by Sheriff Royce Rhodes, Deputy Edward Davis Jr., and Game Warden Carl Willis. Without saying much, still struggling with the horror show he'd uncovered, Brickhouse directed the men towards the pit, later described as 4 feet deep and approximately the width and length of a bathtub. Once Sheriff Rhodes saw the charred bodies, he immediately reached out to the State Bureau of Investigation for assistance, and they dispatched agents Lewis Young, Lenny Wise, and William Godley, who arrived shortly thereafter. Initially, 2 bodies were easily visible to all at the scene, but when agents Wise and Godley climbed down into the pit and began the process of removing the bodies, the horror only became greater. Beneath the 2 bodies, identifiable as adult females, there were also the remains of 3 male children. The smaller bodies were scorched, though not completely consumed by the fire, leaving authorities with little to indicate their identities. The 2 adult women were fully dressed. The 3 young boys were wearing the remnants of pajamas. The older woman wore a pantsuit with an overcoat that had fur trim. The younger woman was dressed in jeans, a denim jacket, and tennis shoes, along with what appeared to be either a wedding or engagement ring with a diamond. Aside from pajamas, 2 of the boys' heads were wrapped in towels, which was believed to have been done to stem the bleeding during transportation. When asked about it later, Sheriff Rhodes replied, quote, "It was something I've never seen before or since, and I hope to God I never see again." There were no missing persons reports in the area that fit the description of the victims, and so their remains were taken to North Carolina Memorial Hospital in Chapel Hill, in hopes of determining identification. Without knowing the origins of the victims, it would be even more complicated to try and track the suspect or suspects. They had only few clues to work with. Remnants of the clothing worn by some of the victims had labels listing several store names. The younger female victim had shoes from a Hans shoe store. The older was wearing a coat purchased at Saks Fifth Avenue. In addition to the clothing, there was also a price tag on the shovel, which held the letters OCH space HD. Sheriff Rhodes made a public appeal through the media for anyone who may have any knowledge of the victims' identities, though he specified that he did not believe them to be local. Beyond the public appeal, Rhodes also reached out to law enforcement in neighboring counties to ask them to go through recent missing persons cases for any case that might fit with their discovery. Rhodes also requested nearby law enforcement agencies to reach out to local schools to determine if there were any children, like brothers, missing from school. By the next morning, March 3rd, many of the state's top investigators were at the scene while the FBI set up a mobile command post near the county courthouse. The autopsies would be conducted the following day and overseen by Dr. Paige Hudson, the state's chief medical examiner. Pending further information from the pathologist, it was a matter of trying to piece together what few clues they had in hopes of determining identities.
In an interview with CNN, Agent Young explained that he and a colleague spent hours driving around looking for a hardware store in the area whose name would fit with the price tag, but the search was unsuccessful. The next step was to send information out to law enforcement branches throughout the country. While it seemed like a long shot at the time, they did receive a response. The Washington Metropolitan Police Department notified Young that in the nearby town of Potomac, Maryland, there was a store called Poke's Hardware. Around this same time, Shelton Ludford of the Terrell Hardware Company was able to provide the manufacturer's number to investigators, at which time they were informed that the shovel had indeed been sold to that hardware store. In addition to the hardware store, Young also verified the names of nearby stores, Hahn's Shoe Store, as well as Saks Fifth Avenue, not far away, matching locations from which the victim's clothing originated. Not sure of what to do, Young and his colleague proceeded up to Potomac, where they spoke with the owner and employees of the hardware store. And ultimately, left with little to go on, Young posted a flyer in the store showing photographs of their yet unidentified victims that had been taken in the morgue. Several days would pass before they received a call about the flyer. Back in Bethesda, on Monday, March 8th, Detective Joe Sargent received a call from the station. He was dispatched to the Bradford family home in response to the neighbor's report about them possibly being missing. When Sargent arrived, he pulled into the driveway, which was shared with the neighbors, and found the neighbor who had phoned in the report waiting for him. At this time, Sargent was given the neighbor's set of keys to the house, and he made the decision to go in and check things out. On the way toward the home, he noted envelopes stuffed into the mailbox and several unopened newspapers lying on and around the front steps. Upon closer inspection, Sargent noted splashes of blood on the doorstep. Detective Sargent's belief that this would just be a routine check went out the window as he opened the front door and found more droplets of blood leading toward the den and then up carpeted stairs toward the master bedroom. As Sargent climbed the stairs, he noticed splattered blood along the walls. At the top of the stairs, he decided not to proceed further without calling the scene in, but one of the bedroom doors was slightly ajar, and from his position, Sargent could see what was later described as a house of horrors. Sargent explained, quote, "On the walls, the ceiling, anywhere you looked, there was blood. It was plain to see that something terrible happened here." Sargent, who at this time had been a police officer for more than a decade, would describe this as the absolute worst crime scene he'd ever observed. Sargent radioed for assistance and multiple units arrived at the home, which was quickly taped off, and the process of going over the scene to determine what may have happened began. Hearing Sargent's call, one of the radio operators for the department remembered seeing the flyer posted at the hardware store. Sargent was informed about the five bodies that had been discovered in North Carolina days earlier, and when a copy of the flyer was brought to the scene, the neighbor who made the initial call, she was able to positively identify the bodies as those of the Bishop family. The victims were Annette Bishop, age 37, her mother-in-law, Lobelia, age 68, and the Bishop family's three sons, William, age 14, Brenton, age 10, and Jeffrey, age 5. Friends and neighbors described the Bishop family as living a storybook life. Annette and Bradford had been high school sweethearts and seemed to genuinely love one another. After high school, Bradford had gone on to attend Yale while Annette went to Berkeley. They'd married and started a family right away. Annette was repeatedly described as very attractive and fit. At the time of her death, she was taking art classes at the University of Maryland and was highly involved in a tennis program at the country club where she was scheduled to perform in a doubles tournament the next week. Lobelia, even in her late 60s, was described as active as well, with neighbors saying they frequently saw the older woman jogging down the driveway. The boys, they were active too, with Brent performing on the school swim team, while Brad played baseball, performed gymnastics, and swam. The youngest, Jeffrey, he was only in nursery school, but I would imagine he was on the same course as his older brothers. Now, it didn't take long for investigators to notice that one member of the Bishop family, their beloved dog, Leo, a golden retriever, as well as the family station wagon, a maroon Chevy Malibu, were both missing. The family's Volkswagen Beetle was still parked on the side of the house, suggesting that the killer, either Bradford himself or an unknown suspect, left the scene in the station wagon. A witness would later report a vehicle matching the station wagon's description in the vicinity of the location where the bodies had been found in North Carolina. At the time, they didn't know yet if 39-year-old William Bradford Bishop Jr. was a victim or a perpetrator. Neighbors seemed to have less information about Bradford, though he was also described as active, and several noted that he enjoyed riding a motorcycle. The family had only lived in the neighborhood for 2 years. By the next day, March 9th, the story broke, and headlines were splashed with grisly accounts of the scene, the intensity of the murders, and the details about where they had been taken and how the bodies had been disposed of. Police confirmed to the media that bloodstains had been found in all four bedrooms, in addition to blood spatter and droplets throughout the house, on the front steps, and in the driveway. Officer Mike McNally, who had been present at the home, explained to the Washington Times how brutal the murders were. In one of the children's bedrooms, he noted hammer marks on the ceiling above the top bunk, stating, quote, "The number of marks, you know, how many times he must have hit his son." Bloody fingerprints were discovered in the home's bathroom, and they were later confirmed to be those of William Bradford Bishop Jr., leading investigators to believe that he was indeed the perpetrator and not a victim. Dr. Hudson, the pathologist back in Chapel Hill with the victim's remains, he spent 8 hours conducting autopsies and determined that all five victims had been bludgeoned to death with a hammer. Hudson explained that the brutality with which the hammer had been wielded was quite extensive, saying, quote, "When you cave somebody's head in with one blow, why keep hitting them? The fact that there were so many bruises to the children struck me as odd." Hudson also specified that while the beatings had been savage, Lobelia, Bradford's mother, had received the least violent attack out of the group, and that in some instances, her wounds may have been survivable. Dr. Hudson surmised that Lobelia may have been smothered after being lightly struck, or perhaps died as a result of shock and fright. Dr. Robert Albanese, a county medical examiner, estimated that it likely took the suspect more than an hour to dig the hole in which the bodies had been tossed. And he does specify that they were thrown into the hole. They were not placed. The time of their death was ultimately determined to have been late in the evening on March 1st or early in the morning on March 2nd. For almost everyone looking at the case, investigators and reporters alike, they had one major question. Where is William Bradford Bishop?
In an attempt to track down Bradford, authorities were able to obtain his place of work from friends and neighbors, which, as it turned out, was at the State Department, where he held the position of Assistant Chief of Special Trade Activities. After interviewing several individuals at the downtown office, investigators were informed that on March 1st, Bishop had left work early, at approximately 5:30 p.m., claiming he was coming down with the flu. Most of his coworkers describe Bradford as a highly respected man who was kind and intelligent, a man that loved his family. When asked if Bradford seemed upset or out of the ordinary on the first, only one person reported anything strange about Bradford's behavior that day. A coworker and friend, Roy A. Harrell Jr., told investigators that he had seen Bradford exiting the building Monday evening. According to Harrell, he had spoken with Bradford, who was visibly upset. Reportedly, Bradford explained that he'd been passed over for a promotion and he was taking it hard. Harrell tried to calm him down and then hailed a cab for Bradford, who also told him that he was leaving early due to illness. Harrell is the last person to see Bradford at the State Department that day. Over the course of the next several days, with a lot of canvassing and interviewing prospective witnesses, authorities began to piece together the comings and goings of Bradford on the day his family was murdered. After leaving his office in Foggy Bottom at approximately 5:30 p.m., Bradford went to his bank, from which he withdrew $200. After the bank, Bradford proceeded over to the Montgomery Mall, where he purchased a 2.5-pound mini sledgehammer and a 2.5-gallon gas can from the Sears department store. Bradford then drove to a gas station next to the mall, filling the can and the tank to his family station wagon. After these purchases, he went to Polk's Hardware, just a few miles from his home, where he made his final purchase of a shovel and a pitchfork. Police believe that Bishop arrived home sometime between 6:30 and 8:30 p.m. At the time of his arrival, his mother was out walking the dog, and police speculate that Bradford entered the home and first murdered Annette before attacking his mother, Lobelia, upon her return home. He then proceeded into the children's bedrooms and bludgeoned them in their sleep. Reportedly, after committing the murders, Bradford carried the bodies one by one from the house into the station wagon. He then took the family dog, got into the driver's seat, and began the 300-mile drive south to rural North Carolina, where he parked, dug the hole, tossed the bodies in, and set them ablaze before driving off. All in all, from the time Bradford murdered his family to the moment he drove away from the horrific funeral pyre, less than 16 hours had passed. It took authorities an additional week to piece things together, and by the time that they discovered Bradford was behind the gruesome killings, he'd already vanished, and they didn't have the first clue of where he could have gone. An all-points bulletin was placed on the vehicle, and police departments all around the Eastern Seaboard were notified of the crime, given a description of Bradford, and warned that he was likely armed and dangerous. By March 12th, Maryland police obtained a murder warrant for Bradford, while the FBI obtained one for interstate flight. At this time, extensive examination of Bradford's background was underway, and his financial records were being looked at. It was through financial records that they were able to determine some of his travels after disposing of the bodies. On March 2nd, the same day the bodies were set aflame, Bradford used his credit card to purchase a pair of tennis shoes in Jacksonville, North Carolina, some 150 miles to the southwest of Columbia. John Wheatley, who owned the sporting goods store, reported seeing Bradford in the company of an unidentified female. According to Wheatley, the woman stood nearby holding the leash to Bishop's dog. Wheatley described the woman as wearing a beautiful dress, and he thought she may have been Caribbean and she had dark skin. When asked about their behavior around one another, Wheatley told the Baltimore Sun, quote, "They seem very much like a couple." The following day, March 3rd, a waitress in Wilmington, 60 miles south of Jacksonville, reported that a man fitting Bradford's description had entered the Copper Kettle Pancake House where she worked. The man behaved oddly, tipping the waitress $2 before she even served him. After eating, he reportedly insulted a few black patrons before tipping the waitress an additional dollar, saying that he needed to get back on the road. At this time, investigators believe Bradford was still in the country, so police began patrolling airports in Maryland, North Carolina, and Florida on the off chance that he might try to escape. During their search of the Bishop home, the passports of all family members were located. However, Bradford had a diplomatic passport and had traveled extensively for his job. That passport was not recovered from the residence. The State Department stated that his possession of a diplomatic passport would not in any way give him any special advantages when it came to trying to leave the country, though. It was a race against time, as soon Dr. Herbert Clue, a psychiatrist and special agent for the FBI, noted that Bradford had been taking a prescription medication known as Cerax, and that without his medication, he may become suicidal and should be considered armed and extremely dangerous. 10 days after police entered the Bishop home and made their horrifying discovery, they'd get the next major break in trying to track down Bradford. On March 18th, C.E. Hinrichs, a national park ranger, received reports of an abandoned vehicle in the Elkmont campground in Great Smoky Mountains National Park near Gatlinburg, Tennessee. Upon arrival, Hinrichs found a 1974 maroon Chevy Malibu station wagon with the license plate DFL-896. He stood behind the wagon, jotting the plate down in his notepad, and then he glanced through the back window. In the rear of the vehicle, he noticed the unmistakable sight of large quantities of dried blood. Hinrichs notified the police, and by 3:30 p.m., 10 FBI agents from the nearby Knoxville office were on the scene. The area was quickly sealed off, and investigators began a forensic examination of the vehicle, which had been reportedly sitting in the lot since March 6th. Inside the Chevy, investigators found bloody clothes, a bloody blanket, a shotgun, an axe, a package of personal hygiene items, maps of the Smoky Mountains National Park, the credit card receipt from the shoes purchased in Jacksonville, prescription bottles with Bradford's medication still inside, dog treats, dog prints, and dog fur. The vehicle had blood all over the interior. The wheel well, which housed the spare tire, contained inches of thick, congealed blood. The area in which the vehicle was found was near a popular hiking trail. Investigators considered that Bradford, who was known to enjoy camping, fishing, and getting out into nature, may have packed some items and headed into the densely forested national park, which covers more than 520,000 acres. Notifications were sent out to anyone planning to or already hiking the trail to be on the lookout and consider terminating their hikes early to avoid running into Bradford. The same day the Bishop vehicle was found, Bradford's wife, mother, and three young sons were arriving in California for burial.
Back at the park, bloodhounds were utilized to track Bradford's scent from the vehicle, and over the course of the next few days, FBI agents and park rangers gathered up in teams combing through the area. Early on, FBI agents received information that a man fitting Bradford's description had appeared at the Sugarlands Visitor Center in early March, days after the killings, and he requested a map while mentioning that he'd camped there before. One of the tracking dogs did detect Bradford's scent at the visitor center, though ultimately none of the dogs were able to lead investigators to him. Later, a wingtip-style shoe was recovered from along the Appalachian Trail. Though it couldn't be directly tied to Bradford, it did seem out of place. Searchers covered a wide swath of land for a week, but on March 26th, all searches were called off due to a lack of results and a lack of resources. A shallow grave was discovered a few weeks later near Newt Prong, an isolated stream known for drawing casual fishing. Ranger Dwight McCarter went to the grave and took photographs of it, showing multiple stones stacked on top of one another and a makeshift cross made of sticks bound together with parachute cords. McCarter elected not to dig the grave up, though he long suspected it was likely the resting place of Leo, the Bishop family dog. Years later, when others went to look for the grave, the area was overgrown and the cross had been lost to time. The discovery of the station wagon seemed to confirm everything investigators had surmised, that William Bradford Bishop, for reasons unknown, had left his job, purchased the items necessary for his crime, and then brutally murdered his entire family before moving the bodies, setting them on fire, and abandoning his car in the Great Smoky Mountains. Unfortunately, the station wagon would be the last major piece of evidence investigators would find. Whether Bradford had hiked down the trail and spent time in the forest, or was even still there, or if he'd flown out of the country, run off somewhere else, they just couldn't say. Searches were being conducted in multiple states, from the area of Spindale, North Carolina, to Gatlinburg, Tennessee, and even some locations in Florida. The story had gone international, with major newspapers all around the world talking about the savage crime and displaying photos of the man believed to have committed the crime. Law enforcement now knew who was responsible for killing the Bishop family and how the murders played out, but the lingering question for everyone was why. What had led William Bradford Bishop to, seemingly on the spur of the moment, murder his entire family and flee? In the hopes of discovering that answer, investigators would need to first determine who William Bradford Bishop was. Born in Pasadena, California on August 1, 1936, Bradford was the son of a geologist, William Bradford Bishop Sr., and a stay-at-home mother, Lobelia Amaryllis, who at one time had dreamed of being a Hollywood actress or professional singer. Bradford was an only child, and little is known about his early years, outside of the fact that his mother seemed to have doted on him, and he was noted for being remarkably intelligent. Jacques Dambois, a renowned ballet dancer, met Bradford when he was 14. Bradford's parents were big fans of the ballet, and according to Dambois, he lived with the family for a short period of time when he was 17. Dambois described teenage Bradford as incredibly smart and determined, saying that they played games together and Bradford was always exceptionally determined to win. Dambois kept in touch with Bradford over the years and actually had plans to stay with the family through March 2, 1976, the day after the killing, but due to an injury, Dambois had to cancel. In his memoir, he wondered, quote, "Had Carrie and I been with them, would we have added our blood to the house? Would we have been in the fire pit? Or would our presence somehow have deflected or deferred the killings?" Dambois is still alive. He just turned 84, making him just a couple of years older than the subject of today's case. Bradford attended Pasadena High School, where he would meet Annette Weiss. Weiss was born in Ohio, but raised in Southern California. The two were quickly drawn to one another and began a relationship which would run for the rest of Annette's life. Bradford graduated in 1954 and went on to attend Yale, where he studied economics. According to college friends, Bradford was incredibly smart, even for the Yale crowd. He played football his freshman year and often spoke about possibly becoming a doctor. Bradford dropped out of Yale for a year at one point, but he returned and graduated in 1959. After obtaining his bachelor's degree, Bradford married Annette in August of 59, and days later, on August 7th, he enlisted in the United States Army. In the Army, Bradford was enrolled in intelligence school in Baltimore. A year later, he studied Serbo-Croatian in the Army's language school in Monterey, California. It was here that Annette would give birth to their first son in 1961. Just over a week after the happy occasion, Bradford was assigned to the 163rd Military Intelligence Battalion. This required shipping over to Europe, and once they were fit to travel, Annette and their son, William Bradford Bishop III, would join him. While Bradford would be stationed in multiple areas over the next 2 years, he spent the vast majority of his time in Italy. Bradford loved traveling and he loved being abroad, but he wasn't fond of his work, which consisted mostly of translating Serbo-Croatian papers and books to English. In 1963, Bradford, now with the rank of staff sergeant, accepted an honorable discharge. The family chose to stay in Italy a while longer, with Bradford enrolling in Italian classes at the Florence campus of Middlebury College. After completion, the family left Italy, returning to Pasadena, where Annette would give birth to their second son, Brenton Germain Bishop. By 1965, Bradford was in Washington, D.C., where he entered the State Department's Foreign Service Program. It didn't take long for him to climb the ladder, as by November of 65, he was promoted to Foreign Service Officer Grade 7. His first overseas assignment would come the next month, just days before Christmas, when he and his family traveled to Ethiopia, where Bradford worked as a junior officer in the U.S. Embassy. In January of 68, Bradford transferred to Milan, Italy, where he would stay until the following year after receiving another promotion. In 1970, the family returned to California, where Bradford would attend UCLA, graduating a year later with a master's in African studies. That same year, the family would welcome their third and final son, Jeffrey Corder Bishop. Not long after the birth of Jeffrey, Bradford returned to Washington, at which time he was assigned to the East African Office of the Bureau of African Affairs. Bradford's father passed away around this time, and his mother, Lobelia, came to live with the family in Washington. And just 1 year later, in 1972, she would travel with them to Gaborone, Botswana, where Bradford was assigned as deputy chief, second only to the ambassador himself. The family remained in Botswana for 2 years before returning to the United States, where they purchased a split-level home for $100,000 in 1974. The house was located at 8103 Lily Stone Drive, Bethesda, Maryland. The beautiful home, which the family loved, would just 2 years later become the scene of 5 brutal murders. And if you are interested, the house is on Zillow, and the listing features some photos of the interior. It's worth mentioning that the house is largely unchanged from its layout at the time of the murders. According to friends, the Bishop family seemed perfect. Annette was an artist and an athlete who was afforded time to pursue her interests, as Lobelia was happy to step in and perform the day-to-day work of being the family's mother figure. Two of their sons were athletes, with the third likely going to pursue the same path. 8mm film shows the family laughing, joking around, and embracing. In one, Bradford sits in a chair on the front lawn holding Jeffrey in his arms. Less than 2 years later, he will murder Jeffrey, along with the rest of his family, using a 2.5-pound mini sledgehammer. How could that happen? What would drive someone to commit such a heinous crime against his own family? There are several different perspectives on this.
Friends and colleagues noted that Bradford's biggest fear was that someday he'd find himself tied to a desk job at the State Department. And in January of 1975, that's exactly what happened. Bradford was given the position of Assistant Chief of Special Trade Activities and Commercial Treaties. Reportedly, Bradford loved traveling, being out in the field, and getting his hands dirty. Several friends said he had a genuine disdain for bureaucrats and was worried that, sitting behind a desk all day, he would become what he despised. Instead, he chose to focus on becoming an ambassador, no easy task by any measure. Everyone knew he was going after the position, looking to be promoted from within the State Department. On March 1st, 1976, the promotion listing was posted, and Bradford didn't make it. According to friend and colleague Roy Harrell Jr., there may have been more to this story. Harrell, in several interviews, noted that Bradford had an inferiority complex, but also a large ego. According to Harrell, both Bradford's mother and wife told him his career was a dead end and that he wasn't going to get anywhere he desired. When the promotion list came out, Harrell suspected that aside from being the straw that broke the camel's back, it may have caused Bradford to fear the response of his family to what, in his eyes, was a failure to achieve, and his violent and vicious acts may have been a way to silence their criticisms. There were also reports at the time that the Bishop family were experiencing some financial issues. How severe the issues were depends on whose opinion you believe. In some places, the issues are described as fairly minor. In others, there is speculation that the Internal Revenue Service was auditing the family's tax returns, though the IRS would neither confirm nor deny their involvement with the Bishop's finances. We know that at the time of the murders, Bradford was making $25,962 a year. That translates to around $117,000 a year today. This income wouldn't stretch far in Bethesda, especially living in a $100,000 house. A house valued at more than $500,000 today, belonging to country clubs, paying for private schools, sports for the kids, and college for Annette, with whom, it's been said, Bradford was frustrated as she was looking to expand her horizons while he wanted her to simply be a stay-at-home mom. Beyond that, Bradford wanted his career to take them back into the world, traveling abroad. But Annette was hesitant, wanting to provide a stable life for the children while not wanting to give up her academic pursuits. There have also been comments that Bradford's relationship with his mother was tense, defined by some as strained but salvageable. The origin of the issues between Bradford and his mother are unknown, but if indeed they were having problems with money, moving his mother into the family home could have exacerbated things. One possible point of contention may also have been related to finances, as it's been reported that Lobelia fronted Bradford $30,000 as a down payment on the Bethesda home. But was this really enough to make a man murder his entire family and disappear? Or was there a darkness growing inside of him for a long time?
Reportedly, after the murders, the State Department became aware of Bradford's psychiatric history, which had been previously hidden. Records indicate that Bradford initially contacted and visited with a psychiatrist during his time at UCLA between 1970 and 1971. The visit was allegedly related to mood issues and insomnia. Before leaving for Botswana later in 72, he visited a physician and complained that he was experiencing back pain, though the doctor could find no cause and determined that the symptoms were likely psychosomatic, referring him to a second psychiatrist. During his time in Botswana, Bradford was also reported to have continued complaining of back issues and seeing doctors, failing to mention his previous visits stateside. Upon return to the U.S. in 1974, Bradford began seeing his third psychiatrist, and this time he was given a prescription, Cirax, which at the time was prescribed to assist with depression, anxiety, and insomnia. Cirax is a brand name for oxazepam, a benzodiazepine which today is used for treating anxiety or alcohol withdrawal, while also functioning as a sleep aid for insomniacs. Like many medications, Cirax has a long list of side effects, though in this case, the ones that draw the most interest are amnesia, forgetfulness, trouble concentrating, tremors, sleep disturbances, and mental and mood changes. Less common side effects include hallucinations, restlessness, confusion, anger, and aggression. I should note, in many descriptions of Bradford, it's said that he loved drinking scotch and wine. And oxazepam, when mixed with alcohol, can cause impairment to thinking and judgment, as well as dizziness, drowsiness, and difficulty concentrating. Bradford's last psychiatrist, the one who prescribed the medication, soon after closed down his private practice and returned to military service. When a reporter from the Honolulu Advertiser asked the doctor about Bradford, he would not answer any questions, citing doctor-patient privilege and saying, quote, "If he turns up, he could sue me." The psychiatrist passed away in 2005. And remember, Cirax was found in the station wagon, suggesting that Bradford had either stopped taking it or would run out, and so notifications were sent around the country to pharmacies. However, Dr. Clue of the FBI added that without the drug, Bishop could get extremely depressed. Stopping a drug like this cold turkey can lead to some difficult side effects and withdrawal symptoms. One item which may grant insight into the mind of William Bradford Bishop was his diary. The diary had an interesting journey, having been auctioned off with the contents of the Bishop family home in July of 76. A woman later purchased the book from a flea market in Greensboro, North Carolina in 2000. On the first page, it said, "Bradford Bishop Diary." And when the woman's son looked him up, she contacted police and handed the book over. In the diary, Bradford discusses some of his issues, including insomnia. And as the years progress through the diary, the more erratic his handwriting seems to become, moving from neatly scrawled lines to jagged, jutting sentences that veer off the lines. One entry from February 27, 1967, reads in part, quote, "toxic, degenerative, psychosis, chronic, low-level maniac, involutional megalomania." 6 months later, in August of 67, he writes, quote, "I am getting better. I am on the threshold. I recognize now that to twist my accursed confines, I must develop a continuing and constant sense of surging for confidence, awe and becoming and love. This is my greatest challenge, for this has always been the great impediment to freedom and total self-realization, to burst the bounds. Another entry dated 1971, the year the diary ends, reads in part, quote, "Your family grows more beautiful, and still you stand on the threshold. Outwardly, your accomplishments are great. My, such symbols, promotions, citations, languages, degrees, still you stand on the threshold. You have soared to the heights and plummeted each time to the depths." Another line that stands out simply says, quote, "This accursed insomnia makes me sleazy." It seems clear, given Bradford's psychiatric history and the entries in his diary, that there was something at work inside of him that today we would definitely associate with any number of mental health issues. As a result, to this day, many in the field of psychology have studied his diary in hopes of unlocking the vault into the darker depths of his psyche and what role it could have played on his behaviors. While generally Bradford was described positively, the FBI would later release a statement in which he was defined as intense and self-absorbed, prone to violent outbursts, and that he preferred a neat and orderly environment. Having three young sons in the home, that is not conducive to a neat and orderly environment. Thousands of sightings of Bishop have been reported over the years. A caller in the 1980s notified Montgomery County Police that he believed he spoke with a man who could have been Bishop in the southwestern United States in 1980, but was unaware of the story until much later. None of these sightings could ever be confirmed, but there are three which authorities believe may have been legitimate. The first of these took place in July of 78 in Stockholm, Sweden. This report came from a woman who had previously known the Bishop family during the time they were in Ethiopia. According to her account, Bishop had grown a thick beard, and she'd seen him in a public park on several occasions. Reportedly, the woman said she was absolutely certain it was Bishop, but she didn't report the sighting until months later when she learned he was wanted for murder. As a result of this sighting, Swedish authorities launched a six-month investigation. The FBI sent an agent to the country to follow up, but nothing was ever found to prove Bishop had been in Sweden. The second sighting came the following year, in 1979. Roy A. Harrell Jr., the man who last spoke to Bradford at work the day of the murders, had an incredible encounter in Sorrento, Italy. According to Harrell, he was waiting to take a bus to Rome and stepped into the men's room before boarding. As he entered the restroom, he saw a bearded man who, judging from his clothes and appearance, he thought could be a transient. And according to Harrell, he stood beside the man at the sink and then turned and looked at him. Harrell would later explain, quote, "In my mind's eye, I stripped off the beard and saw the Foreign Service officer I had known in D.C. I just impulsively said, 'You're Brad Bishop, aren't you?' And he began trembling and shaking and said, 'Oh God, no,' and turned around. I have no doubt it was him." Harrell pursued the man, but he disappeared into the rainy afternoon. And the third sighting came 15 years later, in September of 1994. A former neighbor who had lived near the Bishops in Bethesda was boarding a train in Basel, Switzerland. According to the woman, as she took her seat on the train, she turned and looked out across the platform at another train, and there, framed in the window, she saw a well-groomed man who she is certain was William Bradford Bishop. The woman explained that as soon as she spotted him, the doors closed and the train began moving, leaving her no time to act or get a closer look. Outside of these three sightings, all of which took place outside of the United States, authorities have never listed any other sightings as credible.
William Bradford Bishop has been missing since March of 1976. Having left behind a wealth of items and evidence, there are three items outside of Bradford himself that have never been located: his diplomatic passport, wallet, and the mini sledgehammer that was used to murder his wife, mother, and three young sons. For 43 years, Bishop has been in the wind with speculation rampant that he took his own life in the Great Smoky National Forest, or fled the country and is living abroad, or perhaps remained inside the United States, where he used his training and intelligence to carve out a new life for himself. Despite the vast amount of time that has elapsed, new details continue to emerge from time to time. Authorities have stated that it's possible Bradford was living in Sorrento, Italy, as recently as 2010. However, they also listed Switzerland, Eastern Europe, and even California as possible locations where Bradford may reside. In 2010, the FBI released a letter written by federal prison inmate Albert Kenneth Bankston, a convicted bank robber. In the months leading up to the murders, Bankston and Bradford exchanged several letters. Montgomery County Sheriff Ray Kite reported that after reading the letter and speaking with two individuals named in the letter, it appeared that Bradford had been inquiring about hiring a shooter to commit murders for him in exchange for a clean passport. It's believed by law enforcement that Bradford first tried to hire someone to murder his family before choosing to do it himself. One man mentioned in the letter, David Paul Allen, was interviewed via telephone from prison and explained that Bradford had paid him and some others in cash and jewels to pose as home repair workers and murder his family while he was on a trip overseas. Bradford was scheduled to travel to Geneva from January 27th to February 6th, 1976, having him returning less than a month before he himself would commit the murders. Bankston died in 1983, before the letter was discovered, and authorities were never able to question him about their correspondence. In one of the letters, Bankston wrote, quote, "Now, in answer to your question, yes, I am most sure she is in the North Carolina State Penitentiary." This vague reference to a woman made authorities wonder if she could be the dark-skinned woman seen with Bradford in Jacksonville, North Carolina, the day after the murders. Could this be why Bradford went down to North Carolina in the first place? That answer remains unknown. In 2014, the remains of a John Doe who had been killed in a hit-and-run while walking along an Alabama highway near Scottsboro in 1981 were exhumed. The unidentified man bore physical similarities to Bradford, and these were recognized by Alabama police while going through records, at which time they found photos of the John Doe. The FBI was notified, and after some discussion, DNA was taken for comparison. After several weeks of eagerly waiting, the FBI were given the bad news. The man was not William Bradford Bishop. It was another letdown, as just a few years earlier in 2011, fingerprint records were used to prove that two deceased men, one in China and the other in France, were not Bradford either. Also in 2014, the FBI enlisted the help of forensic artist Karen Taylor, who created a sculpture of Bradford to reflect how he may appear at the age of 77. The sculpture was then mixed with digital image editing to show variations of Bradford with different hair lengths, hair colors, eyewear, and facial hair. On April 10th, 2014, William Bradford Bishop was added to the FBI's 10 Most Wanted Fugitives list. Just last year, on June 27th, Bradford was removed from that list. The FBI later explained that they planned to replace the then 81-year-old with a more dangerous fugitive. When last seen, William Bradford Bishop was described as being a white male standing 6 feet 1 inch tall and weighing 180 pounds. He has brown eyes, and at the time, his hair was brown, though it may be gray and thinning now. Bradford has a cleft chin, a mole on his left cheek, and a 6-inch surgical scar on his lower back. He was an accomplished outdoorsman and has a pilot's license. In his free time, he enjoys riding motorcycles and working out. He's reported to be fond of dogs, prefers drinking scotch or wine, enjoys peanuts and spicy foods. At the time of his disappearance, Bradford may have been in possession of his Yale class ring and possibly his father's .38 revolver with the serial number C981967. If alive today, Bradford would be 82 years old. He is wanted on 5 counts of first-degree murder, and a $100,000 reward remains active.
I've tried a lot of different deodorants, and Native is the only one I trust. Native creates safe, simple, effective products that people use in the bathroom every day. They create products with trusted ingredients and trusted performance. Not convinced? Check out any of their 8,000 five-star reviews. Native works. Don't hold back. Native can hang with your workout, busy mom life, or 16-hour day. People love Native, And you can hear all about their success stories on the Today Show, in Women's Health, Elle, Good Morning America, Pop Sugar, Nylon, Hello Giggles, and so many more. Less is more with Native, and they have fewer ingredients so you know everything that's in your deodorant. It's worth it. Aluminum may be linked to some serious health ramifications. Although Native is priced at a slight premium when compared to conventional deodorants, it's safe and effective. Native comes in a wide variety of enticing scents for men and women. Plus, they release new limited edition seasonal scents throughout the year. They even provide an unscented formula and baking soda free formula for those with sensitivities. I personally love the cucumber and mint scent and find it lasting throughout my entire day no matter how hard I push myself. It's comforting to use a product that's safe, where I know what it's made of, and that is incredibly effective. For 20% off your first purchase, visit nativedeodorant.com and use the promo code TRACE. You don't want to miss out on this amazing offer. So visit nativedeodorant.com and use promo code TRACE. That's T-R-A-C-E for 20% off your first order today. Quickly, before getting into the theories, I wanted to once again thank Nina for working with me on this. If you haven't already, make sure you check out her podcast, Already Gone. It's amazing, and Nina is a fantastic host. Now, when we did this episode in Chicago, we only had an hour to work with, and so we didn't have much time to discuss too much in terms of theories. After completion of the live recording, I made some notes about theories and wanted to tack them on here to make this a complete episode and to explore some of the possibilities as pertains to what became of William Bradford Bishop. I do have to make one note here before we get into the two theories that are predominantly discussed when it comes to this case. In some places, and by far this is in the minority, there is somewhat of a conspiracy theory about Bradford. Many people believe the possibility that Bradford could have been working not for the State Department as a diplomat, but perhaps working for an intelligence agency as a covert operative. While there's no evidence to really support this, I guess the question really is, what evidence would we expect to find? If he was a spy, it's not like the government's going to acknowledge that one of their own short-circuited and murdered his whole family. With the spy angle, some people believe one of two scenarios could have happened. Either Bradford was found by covert agents working for another country, who then struck out against him, murdering his family and probably Bradford himself, but arranging things to look like he'd committed the crime. On the flip side, some people believe that Bradford could have done something to either betray his own organization or maybe just select individuals within that organization, and they could have responded by murdering his family and then setting him up. While these are fascinating to look at, I've never found much to support them, if I've found anything at all. I can't say with 100% certainty that neither of these possibilities happened, but I do my best to follow evidence and apply logic, and while these make a good movie, see the Bourne films for instance, I don't think they're grounded in reality, at least not without something solid to support them. I wasn't initially even going to address these theories, but I figured if I didn't, someone was going to ask me why not. I'm not saying that Bradford couldn't have been a spy, by the way. I was just saying that given what we know about the items he purchased, sightings of him, and details of the crime, all evidence seems to point to him as the perpetrator and not as the victim of a grand conspiracy. So I wanted to lay that out first before moving into the two vastly more popular theories on this case. We'll begin with the first theory, that William Bradford Bishop walked into the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and either died as the result of an injury or exposure, or maybe took his own life with his father's missing .38 revolver. We know that Bradford's car was found in the parking lot, and there was a reported sighting of him requesting a map. Also, while tracking dogs weren't able to follow much, there were indications that they'd picked up on his scent at the park's visitor center. There was also that shoe that was found in the woods. Bradford had made mention that he'd camped out there before, and we know that he was an experienced outdoorsman, so it isn't beyond the realm of possibility to imagine that part of his plan may have involved abandoning the vehicle, going out into the park, and either killing off enough time to walk out elsewhere, or maybe the plan did involve intentions to take his own life. First and foremost, the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, is gigantic. You're talking about an area of more than 500,000 acres, covering five different counties in two separate states. The park itself contains more than 850 miles of hiking trails, carrying you through various kinds of terrain, from dense forestry to open fields, from towering mountaintops to gentle rolling hills. There's a little bit of something for everyone, and there are areas that are calm and easier, more fit for beginners, while there are also more treacherous areas approached only by experienced and skilled hikers. Given Bradford's experience, he could have gone anywhere once he entered the park. We aren't sure exactly what he had with him, besides the family dog, though with his father's revolver missing, most people believe he had it with him. The question became whether the gun was with him for protection, to assist him maybe in hunting should he grow desperate, or to take his own life. So let's look at the accident exposure angles of the theory first. Obviously, given the terrain, any number of accidents could have occurred. Bradford could have fallen from a steep peak, been swept away by rushing waters, or simply found himself lost. We aren't sure of what exactly Bradford's level of experience was with this area, but given that he chose to drive all the way from near Columbia, North Carolina, to Gatlinburg, Tennessee, nearly 500 miles, to this park, there's a good chance this was either a place he felt comfortable, or maybe a place where he thought he could hide out from the authorities for a time. There is, of course, the possibility that Bradford had no intention of staying in the park and merely left his vehicle there to throw investigators off the trail. It wouldn't matter how large your search party was. If someone wandered into this park, they'd be hard to find. If they were actively attempting to avoid being found, I'd say there's an extremely low likelihood that you're gonna find them at all. A lot of people have gone missing in national parks over the years. Many of them have never been found, nor their remains recovered. So the idea that Bradford could have gone into the park and possibly have never left is definitely there. So could Bradford have been injured and found himself in a position where he simply couldn't get out, and as a result, died from his injuries or exposure? Yeah. We also have to consider the wildlife population of the park, which includes bears, bobcats, and coyotes, among others. Were Bradford to have come into contact with an animal who was able to attack and overwhelm him, I doubt his chances of survival were very high. If he did have the revolver, that might have been able to aid him were he to come face to face with a predator, but it was certainly no guarantee that he'd survive. An animal attack could have easily killed or subdued him. So on top of a park which possesses areas that can be physically challenging and dangerous, he also has to contend with dangerous wildlife. Were he to have been attacked or even killed by an animal, others would likely come along to pick the bones, and now you're trying to locate the remnants of human remains in such a massive section of land. It would be nearly impossible to find and recover those remains, especially if he had gone off the hiking trails and in a very wooded area or an area that was difficult to reach. So the possibility that Bradford died due to an accident or animal attack is difficult to argue against, but then there's the idea that he may have gone to the park with the intention of taking his own life. And this is a section of this theory that can't be ignored. Considering the writings in Bradford's journal, it seems apparent that he was experiencing a decline in his mental health. We also know that his prescribed medication, Xerax, was found in the station wagon. Whether or not Bradford had more on him and simply chose to leave some behind, or if he left it all behind, we can't know for sure. However, depending how long he was planning to be in the park, there's the possibility his medication could have run out. And it was already noted by the FBI that without that medication, he could become deeply depressed and could be a danger to himself and others. We also have to factor in the statements of the park ranger, Dwight McCarter, who alleged to have found what he believed to have been a shallow grave. Obviously, Bradford couldn't have taken his own life and then buried himself, but many have wondered whether or not it's possible that this could have been the resting place of the Bishop family dog, who we know was in Bradford's company at the time. There's a couple of things which could have led to the dog's death, but many believe Bradford himself may have been the killer, burying his dog either to help cover his tracks or in preparation to take his own life. Oftentimes, when someone takes their own life, they'll go someplace with good memories, someplace they feel good, someplace they feel safe. It's entirely possible that Bradford had some kind of emotional connection to the park based on past experiences and could have gone there specifically to take his own life. The shallow grave really bothers me. We have no way of knowing what was actually buried there and why the park ranger decided to take a picture of it but not report it to anyone until years later completely blows my mind. Given the natures of the crimes he committed, how brutally and savagely he butchered his own family, there's no doubt that his mental state would have been dramatically affected. I could absolutely buy the idea that Bradford went to the park, found himself an area where he could be isolated, and then used the revolver to take his own life. Again, like with an animal attack, if he'd selected a remote enough location, finding him would be challenging, but also, animals are going to come and feed on him, leaving less to find. We know that the area where the grave was later was overgrown and became lost to time. This seems to indicate that the grave was in an area that wasn't frequented by hikers or travelers, which to me supports the idea that Bradford could have gone off the trail and was in areas people didn't normally go. If a grave could be overgrown, so could a decaying body. So the idea that Bradford entered the park and never returned is one which cannot be ignored. Whether it was by his own hand or due to an accident, it's completely in the realm of possibility that somewhere in the vast landscape of that park lies the remains of one of America's most notorious and violent killers. But what if Bradford's life didn't end in the park that day? Where else could he have gone? That question leads us into our second theory, that William Bradford Bishop managed to evade authorities and escape the country. There's no doubt whatsoever that Bradford knew his way around the world. He'd been to Africa, he'd been to Europe, he'd been to a lot of locations. He spoke multiple languages, likely had made contacts over the years, and probably had places he could go if he needed to escape the heat for a while. Remember, one witness who saw Bradford didn't even know he was wanted for murder at the time he was seen. It obviously wouldn't have been all that difficult for him to just head over to Europe, blend into the crowd, and start a new life with a new identity. This isn't just some guy trying to escape the police. This is a man who has experience doing this kind of thing. I don't know exactly how I feel about the sightings of Bradford. Sometimes I think they could be accurate, other times I think people could have been mistaken. Mr. Harrell's sighting, the one which took place in the men's room in Sorrento, Italy, has always been fascinating to me. On the one hand, you'd think Harrell would remember Bradford clearly enough to have made a positive identification, but that's not exactly what happened. Harrell found himself looking into the face of a bearded man, and in his opinion, he thought it was Bradford. I find the beard troublesome, because Harrell had to imagine what he would have looked like without it. It's easy to imagine he could have filled in some of the blanks himself, and then the man would look more like Bradford because that's who he thought it was, but maybe it wasn't him. Eyewitnesses are usually very unreliable, but the fact that Harrell knew Bradford does apply a little more credence to his statements, although sometimes I feel like Harrell just enjoyed being in the spotlight and being associated with this case. Out of all the sightings, I do think that the Sorrento sighting has the most support for being correct. But there's also the possibility that Harrell approached a man in a men's room in Sorrento and just freaked him out, causing him to run off. I do find the verbal exchange fascinating, with Harrell saying, "You're Brad Bishop," and the man apparently responding, "Oh God, no," and then running away. If that's completely accurate, there's a chance it could have been Bradford. Harrell, though, described the man as appearing unkempt and possibly as being a transient. I suppose Bradford could have run into issues which resulted in him having no place to go, running out of money and becoming homeless, but I find it difficult to believe that someone with Bradford's skills, intelligence, and training would have found himself in this position unless he elected to. Then again, we don't know what his mental state was at the time. Bradford had a 9-day head start after murdering his family. It wouldn't have taken him that long to have flown out of the country, and by the time authorities knew who they were looking for, he could have been in a different country, on a different continent, for more than a week already. Given Bradford's skills and experience, and with that head start, the likelihood of authorities being able to track him down in 1976 was fairly limited. I've always wondered if Bradford could have had hidden accounts or some kind of an account in another country with a supply of cash to help him set up a new beginning, should he need to. Remember, based on his conversations with a prison inmate, he may have been planning this for a while and could have been depositing funds somewhere to give himself a safety net. So, if Bradford got out of the United States, he could have gone almost anywhere. Obviously, he had the majority of his experience in Europe and Africa, so those would be two likely places for him to go. But that's a lot of ground to cover when you're looking for a man who not only knows local customs and speaks the language, but who also has lived in these places and knows how to blend in. On top of all of that, there's been discussions over the years of Bradford's employment. As I mentioned at the beginning, many people believe that while he operated as a diplomat, this could have been a cover for a career working as a spy, possibly for the CIA. So what do we have to support that, really? Well, not much. But a foreign diplomat who speaks multiple languages and who also has had extensive training in counterintelligence is a little suspicious, isn't it? Also, it's important to note, Bradford had been at Yale, then the Army, and then the State Department during a time where we know the CIA was involved in experiments involving LSD and mind-altering drugs. Project MKUltra, for instance, began in 1953 and was reportedly ended in 1973. Bradford graduated from Yale in 1959, went straight into the Army, and then became a part of the State Department in 1968. There's a lot to cover when it comes to this possibility, and while we have nothing really to support Bradford being involved in any of the experimental programs, it could possibly explain some of his psychological issues later on, although those could have just been latent in him and developed later. So while that can't be confirmed, it is something that should be considered, because if Bradford did at any time operate as a spy or have associations with the CIA, he likely would have had skills and training that we, as the public, would have no knowledge of, which could have contributed to his abilities to disappear. For the most part, people are fairly split on what happened to Bradford, with many believing he died or took his own life, and an equal amount supporting the idea that he could have easily fled the country and escaped. I tend to lean more towards escaping the country. Given Bradford's writings and the knowledge that he had a large ego but also an inferiority complex, I struggle to imagine him taking his own life. Yes, it's entirely possible, especially given his mental state, but a huge part of me believes this is a guy who could justify anything to himself and who would likely blame everyone around him for issues rather than looking at himself. I just don't imagine a guy this full of himself is going to take his own life. That seems like he'd be admitting that he couldn't escape or that he'd done something wrong. And I just think Bradford was more the type to move on with his life and convince himself that what he did was something he had to do. There's far too much to get into when it comes to Bradford's psychology, and I'm not well-versed enough to really give you a thorough analysis. However, consider that this man brutally murdered his wife, mother, and three young sons. That certainly seems like he was having some kind of a psychotic break. What role that may have played in his plans or his attempts to escape is unknown. I've always wondered why he committed the murders in the first place. If you want to disappear, then disappear. You don't have to murder your family to do so. But maybe that's an indication of how vast his psychological break really was. Obviously, authorities don't lean as much into the suicide or death in the park theories. They've continually released new sketches of him over the years, added him to the FBI's most wanted list as recently as 2014, and had sculptures made showing what he might look like today. This makes it seem like they believe, above all else, that he's still out there somewhere. Now, whether or not Bradford is still alive today could be debated. He'd be 82 years old, and it's definitely a possibility that he's out there living in some isolated location, or maybe even amongst the populace of a large city, completely invisible and hiding in plain sight. There's also the chance that he could have escaped the country and lost his life in any number of ways later. Illness, accidents. I think it's important also to note that several items in Bradford's possession have never been found. I suppose he could have gotten rid of them, the revolver, his Yale class ring, but if they were important enough to take with him, maybe they were important enough to hang on to, but that's hard to say. Ultimately, there's a very good chance that someone with Bradford's skills and intelligence managed to evade authorities, escape the country, and create an entirely new life and identity. Back in 1976, it likely wasn't too difficult to create a false identity, especially in another country. And even if he wanted to return to the United States as this new person, with no one the wiser. Now, they do have Bradford's fingerprints and DNA on file, so if he did return to the U.S., he obviously was never arrested for anything, or he'd have been identified, and that may have been a little risky in his opinion. I could easily see Bradford just staying out of the country for the rest of his life. He always wanted to travel outside of the U.S. anyway, so I don't know why he'd return here in the first place. There was nothing left here for him. So I believe there's a good chance Bradford did escape, and a lesser, but still existent chance, that he's still alive out there somewhere today. William Bradford Bishop Jr. committed one of the most disturbing, grisly, and brutal crimes you can imagine. A beautiful family was utterly destroyed when this sadistic man walked out of his office, drove over to the store, and began purchasing the items he'd need to kill his family and dispose of their bodies. Three young boys, his brilliant wife, and his loving mother, all killed in a way which makes it incredibly difficult to imagine that the man who killed them had ever loved them. But we also know we're looking at a man who was walking a fine line between genius and insanity, who was writing more and more insane thoughts in his journal, and who, according to friends and coworkers, felt that his wife and mother did not believe in his future or his abilities to expand his career. What it was that ultimately set Bradford off, we may never know. Some people believe the loss of the promotion he sought caused this, but if he was planning the murders earlier and hoping to hire someone to commit them, that doesn't really follow through. Maybe the promotion led him to finally make the choice to do it himself, but this was clearly a man who had become a monster, a ticking time bomb that was going to explode at one point or another. For all the questions that revolve around this case, there seems to be a very slim chance we're ever going to get the answers. As for the fate of William Bradford Bishop, this remains unknown, and unless Bradford himself is found, more witnesses come forward with sightings, or something new is discovered to revitalize this case, the murder of the Bishop family will remain open while the case continues to grow cold. If you're looking for more information about the Bishop family murders, many news programs have covered this case. Unsolved Mysteries has touched on it, and there are a ton of online forums and articles you can go to that discuss this case. If you have any information about the Bishop family murders, please contact authorities in Columbia, North Carolina, Bethesda, Maryland, or the FBI. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, Instagram message me at TraceEvidencePod, or comment in the Facebook group. Just a few quick notes here at the end of the show. There will not be an episode next week, Monday, August 12th, as I'll be going out of town, and the show will return Monday, August 19th. Also, I've received all entries for the promo contest, which ended a couple of days ago, and will begin reviewing them for consideration this month. Special shout out and thank you to Trace Evidence Patreon producers Emily Smith, Megan Cotter, Kate Alexander, Chandra Moreau, Julia Rexon, Diane Dyson, Tom Archer, Eamon Brady, Tara Doble, Alicia Lorraine, Krista Colvin, Randy Weiland, and Megan. I want to thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll join me on Monday, August 19th, for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.